Representative Linder, would you like to move the minutes for February 18th?
So moved, Mr. President.
All in favor of the minutes from February 18th, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion approved the minutes. Okay, now we have the report on the Governor's Workforce Development Council and Workforce Services Centers. And who's first? You got Luke, is he first? Oh, Roger is. Okay. Welcome to committee, Mr. Hale. It's a pleasure to see you again.
Thank you very much. Good morning. My name is Roger Hale. I'm chair of the Governor's Workforce Development Council. We are here today to present two reports requested by the 2003 state legislature. The first is an analysis of the Minnesota's dislocated worker programs and recommendations to improve the efficiency and effectiveness of those federal and state programs. Norb Konzemius, who serves on both the GWDC and the JobSkill Partnership Board, chaired an ad hoc committee which completed this study on behalf of the GWDC. Norb will present the findings of the Dislocated Worker Program study. The second study is a study of the governance role of Minnesota's local workforce councils and an analysis of the geographic boundaries of the current workforce service areas in which those local workforce councils operate. David McKenzie, who just recently ended his term on the GWDC, served as chair of the GWDC Systems Excellence Committee, which completed the study on behalf of the council, and Dave will give more detail on the WSA study. I want to make just a few brief points to frame both of these studies. First, I'd like to express our great appreciation to each of you as members of the state legislature who are charged with looking across many programs and agencies to see how they all add up to serving Minnesota workers and businesses. This perspective, which we describe as looking at the whole portfolio, is how the GWDC views its role in advising the legislature and the governor on workforce development strategies. We see ourselves as continually bringing forward the issues that are on the horizon and likely to affect our workforce, economic development, and education investments, and we sometimes look into our portfolio of investments to suggest changes that will serve us better in the long run. We continue to see three broad long-term challenges to keeping Minnesota's economy competitive and moving us towards being the preeminent state in the nation in helping both workers and businesses jointly prosper. These challenges are, one, a long-term skills and labor shortage that, in spite of our most recent jobless recovery, is clearly facing us in the next decade. The march of demographics will not be stopped. We're going to have a great shortage of workers in this country and in this state during the next 10, 15, 20 years, and that shortage will be particularly severe in the skilled worker area. Second challenge, focusing attention on policies and programs that will explicitly help Minnesota workers gain skills and advance in their careers. Minnesota has a strong economic advantage, one of the few that we really have versus other states, and that is we have a high-quality, skilled workforce. We must build to that strength and capitalize on it in the next 10, 20 years. And the third issue challenge is the strengthening communication, data collection, and performance measurement to make our workforce development efforts into a more coherent and effective system. And Mr. McKenzie's report will talk a bit about that. Now, I want to talk just a little small introduction before I turn this over to Norb Konzemius. The Dislocated Worker Program study offers a clear analysis of our federally and state-funded programs that serve dislocated workers. The report makes six recommendations to address process choke points identified in the analysis. I want to underscore that although the full GWDC discussed this study and the executive committee approved the final document, there is disagreement about the specific recommendations in the report. Members of the council, including our vice chair, my esteemed vice chair, Don Gertesmeyer, do not feel the recommendations are acceptable solutions to the issues raised in the analysis. I feel strongly that one of the ways in which the GWDC adds value to state government is its role as a deliberative body with 31 varying perspectives, 31 members, 31 varying perspectives. Our report gives you several of these perspectives to consider, and I want to underscore that this program is just one of many in our entire workforce development portfolio. Now, just to make a comment about the WSA study, which will be the second one presented to you, that clearly fits into the and addresses the challenge of strengthening communications, data collection, and performance measurement. And the WSA study, in that we've advocated for a locally driven system that meets statewide standards and adds up to a few strategic statewide priorities. We want our local workforce councils to be effective local leaders with the support of state agencies providing infrastructure, funding, and guidance. The WSA study makes several recommendations to strengthen the relationships between local workforce councils, the Minnesota Department of Employment and Economic Development, DEED, and other state agencies. And today we are not giving you any proposed changes to the geographic boundaries of Minnesota's workforce service areas. This report identifies several criteria for analyzing the geographic boundaries. The GWDC chose to form a separate ad hoc committee to use the criteria, continue the analysis, and make a recommendation to the governor in June this year when he will have to address this issue for the next round of federally required planning under the Federal Workforce Investment Act. The recommendations that we offer in both these reports need to be understood in the context of Minnesota's portfolio of workforce programs. To meet the three challenges I outlined earlier, we need more strategic investment in education and training in several areas. We have detailed some of the strategies for doing so in our Preeminence Minnesota framework and will continue to make recommendations to the governor and state legislature in support of that framework. We also need to continually strengthen our weaving of many programs and partners into a seamless system. No single program will address all our workforce needs. If legislation is advanced to pursue recommendations from either study, we'll be happy to work with you in any way that is helpful to make certain that the implementation of these ideas is done as effectively as possible. And before calling Mr. Consemius or turning it over to him, I want to remind you again of a very important fact, which is demographics are marching. We're going to have a shortage of workers in the state of Minnesota, and particularly a shortage of skilled workers. Our ability to reinforce our strong quality of workers in this state and to build on the skill base we have will help us be preeminent versus other states in this country during the next 10 to 20 years. Mr. Chairman, thank you very much. I'd like now to turn over to Mr. Consemius to give the first report.
Thank you very much, Mr. Hale. Welcome to committee, Mr. Consemius. Please thank give you. Your name for the record.
My name is Norb Consemius, and as Mr. Hale pointed out, I serve on both the Governor's Workforce Development Council and the Minnesota Job Skills Partnership Board. Just by way of personal background, I'm a former bank executive. I was with for 25 plus years what is now called U.S. Bank, then called First Bank System, and had regional responsibility for banks, including Southern Minnesota, for a period of time, and in the metro, Twin City metro area in the East Market. And then after leaving the bank, I bought a company, so I'm a former business owner. I sold that company about 6 years ago. I'm here today, as Roger pointed out, to present the study which he described, and I just try to move quickly to the issue about the written report, and it contains a detailed description of how the programs operate our analytical processes and the recommendations. I want to highlight the recommendations and then add a few of my own observations personally about the issues. But I also want to reflect the fact that the committee really, the report is a reflection of the consensus of the committee, and we had some dissenting votes, as Roger alluded to, and I respect the diversity of opinion, but we did not try to steer the results. We took a vote and moved forward accordingly. In response to the legislator's request to make recommendations improving the efficiency of the program, we agreed to do a process mapping effort that was expected to highlight how customers are served, how the dollars flow, and where there are possible redundancies or choke points that, if addressed, would improve the outcome for dislocated workers and hence improve the effectiveness, and then to use the resources toward increased program output. So try to get more bang for the buck, so to speak, was the real issue. As we got into it, there seemed to be three main issues that kept popping up. There were waiting lists for service when individual laid off workers go to workforce centers. That was a point that came up in a couple, again and again. And then there may be a delay in determining what other funding streams might be available for that particular layoff. So there were one of the things that we felt strongly about: shouldn't have waiting lists when somebody is unemployed and trying to find another job. Secondly, there's a balance between providing training and facilitating rapid placements. Customers have a different experience if program resources are used to support training and or placement, and in some cases customers may view the dislocated worker programs as an entitlement for training. And so those issues we addressed, as well as there seemed to be a disparity of services for customers depending on whether the layoff qualifies for additional funding, that is the National Emergency Grant or the Trade Adjustment Act, in relative other workforce development programs. Using these three issues as guides, the committee completed a process analysis of the federal and state programs, including the analysis of how the programs operate at the local level. In that process, and looking at that flowchart that I referred to that's on page 10 in the report, we identified six choke points where customer issues surfaced. The report shows the process flow in each of the six choke points. I can highlight a few themes that came up during our discussions that were also prevalent during our discussions. First of all, the dislocated worker program is one of a few resources in Minnesota which can be effectively used for skill training, and consistent with what Mr. Hale said about our demographics and our challenges, that's a very important issue, and it puts a big burden on this program. Second is how to best facilitate informed individual choice for dislocated workers seeking services. Are dislocated workers best served when they choose services through the workforce development system, or are they when in that process, in a mass layoff, when an employee management committee chooses a service provider at the point of dislocation or some combination, which is the best way to go? And we tried to look at whether there was a dollar difference in these two, but that was proved inconclusive. And then the third point is how, where and how to encourage value-added competition among service providers that either results in higher quality and or lower cost of services. There was significant debate about the structure of service delivery for mass layoffs using employee management committee process, as well as the selection of independent grantees and independent and eligible providers to deliver services. And as a personal note, as an aside, I think we'd be better served if we tightened our specifications for the services that we provide, not just on price, but on price and quality together. That's really a personal note. That was not really part of the committee. The result of all of this was that we had six recommendations. Of the six, three represent a consensus among all the committee members, and three received a majority vote, but there were significant dissenting opinion, at least one, and in some cases more than one. The summary of our recommendations then were as follows. First, to create a consistent delivery of information about program expectations through development of additional scripting, templates, and print materials for use by rapid response teams. So the laid-off workers have a good path and a good available information on what resources are available. Secondly, and this was one of the dissenting issues, was to allow for meaningful local response to dislocations by representatives of local elected officials and or local workforce councils in conjunction with the state rapid response team. There was a lot of discussion about when a mass layoff occurs, whether people should, whether the local workforce centers and people should be involved in how that process works. Third, and there was some dissent on this as well, indeed should review eligibility for the state dislocated worker program and work with partners to clarify through program guidance and or staff training the existing definitions of eligibility for the dislocated worker program. Obviously the intent here is that we should be following the intentions of the program and to coordinate where we can between federal and state issues. Our fourth recommendation was to minimize project application requirements by reducing paperwork and some redundancy in paperwork. Fifth, DEED should explore a mechanism to account for individuals who are part of mass layoff projects but have previously been served through formula funds. There appears to be in larger layoffs, the layoff comes if management is not quite sure exactly what the business outlook is. The mass layoff may come with 10 people being laid off in one spot and then another 20 or whatever, and eventually it becomes a mass layoff. But in the meantime, local workforce centers, et cetera, are servicing the people that had been previously laid off. So how do we aggregate that up to provide the best service in those situations? Lastly, the threshold for mass layoffs, we think at least the majority of our committee felt that should be raised from 50 to 200 with no additional changes in the existing mass layoff process. The formula for distribution of the dislocated worker program funds would be significantly increased to account for the additional expected service to dislocated workers by workforce centers and other service providers through formula funding. DEED should have discretion to make additional mass layoff funding available for layoffs under 200 if there is a need is demonstrated and funding is available. And that's really the most controversial piece of what we're talking about here, raising that. The intent and the discussion around that point was really focused on trying to provide more local involvement, more local control, and using the local workforce centers to deal with those situations. That recommendation does require legislative change. Recommendation C could be addressed administratively or with a change in statute. The balance of the recommendations can be accomplished administratively. I'd like to take a moment to explain some of our thinking, and this may be a little repetitive, behind the two recommendations that were the most controversial. The recommendation C to reduce or eliminate the 50% training requirement is simply intended to reduce the bureaucratic burden of requiring that 50% of the funds be spent on training. We believe strongly that training should be provided when it is needed and appropriate. We're simply recommending that the program change from an upfront requirement to a utilization review model where training provided is reported afterwards. And in some cases, this is related to the issue of training being needed when a job has become obsolete. And there there were some examples given that may be very anecdotal, but the point is we shouldn't train. We know we have a shortage of nurses. It wouldn't be appropriate to train nurses to become engineers, for example. And when their training isn't necessary, we shouldn't be doing it. We should be trying to save those dollars. And that was one of the key points. The recommendation with respect to moving the mass layoff projects from 50 to 200 is intended to reduce the number of incidences when mass layoff process is invoked and to allow more individuals to choose service at a workforce center, a union-based provider, a community-based provider, or other point of service in their community. So it's aimed in part at giving the worker more choice in the process. It seems that allowing individuals to choose their own path and point of service with funding delivered to local areas to provide such service is more efficient than creating projects for each layoff of at least 50 people. In these projects, a single provider is chosen to deliver the services, and there is little evidence that this competitive model yields much measurable benefit in quality or outcome. In my own mind, allowing individuals to choose their own provider of service and encourage local workforce councils to ensure that there is adequate choice in a given community is a much more effective way to deliver those services to the workers seeking placement, support, and/or training. And there's obviously diversity of opinion on this issue. Finally, I'd be remiss if I didn't take the opportunity to say that the GWDC feels strongly that Minnesota needs the education, training, and workforce development resources it has to support competitive businesses and workers advancing in their careers and increasing their earnings. So I wholeheartedly support what Mr. Hale said at the outset, and I want to thank you all for the opportunity to make our presentation, and I'd be happy to try to answer any questions you have.
We appreciate your commitment to this, Mr. Consemius. I have a question. You're short or don't have enough dollars for training for the dislocated worker program. I think you referenced that at the beginning of your talk. In your opinion, are those dollars being allocated appropriately between large and small layoffs?
Well, I think one of the issues is that layoffs don't hit the state evenly, and they're hard to predict. I'm not sure I can say that the aggregate dollars are short. I can say that with respect to the distribution of dollars, there's a challenge and a problem because it does not hit evenly. And the thought was that by increasing this threshold, we can deal with, we can maybe better serve the people that have the layoffs. And at the end, in the final analysis, I think at the end of the year, as we look at the mass layoff dollars available, there is enough money in that bucket, or there has been in the recent past.
Hey, do you think with Trade Adjustment Act, federal money coming in and stuff like that that we've had in the last few years, and we've done a wonderful job of getting that money, I think of Finger Hut, I think of LTV, I think of a host of things where we have gotten additional federal monies. Do you think that we have had enough for mass layoffs?
I didn't see any evidence that we have a shortage.
Okay, good. So in your opinion, basically the 50-50 relationship between giving the WSAs 50% of the funds to begin with, and then what do you think of the concept of taking the other 50% and depoliticizing it basically by letting the Job Skills Partnership Board allocate funds from there on for large and small layoffs? You think that would be appropriate way of looking at it?
I'd have to reflect on the issue a little bit more before I gave you a meaningful response. I think the thrust of what we were doing was to try to reduce these log jams that we think exist, or these choke points. And raising that mass layoff threshold and providing more dollars to the workforce centers would reduce the waiting lists. But making the shifts that you're referring to, I think we'd have to reflect on a little bit more.
Okay. Thank you very much. Any other questions? Representative Dorn.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Consimius, could you just elaborate a little bit more for me some of the counter arguments to that most controversial recommendation that you mentioned, the raising the threshold from the 50 to the 200. You talked about it offering more choice, more efficiency.
Yeah.
What were the concerns of people? Because that sounds good to me when I hear you say it. What were the concerns of the people who felt that there was more downside than
we didn't have. Correct me if I'm wrong. There are several members of our committee here, but we didn't have a lot of argument on the other side. I think that one of the issues are is that if the dollars go to the workforce centers, will the independent providers have the same access to the training of the individuals than if it comes through a mass layoff where those providers have a chance to compete for the larger layoffs? That's one issue. It may not be the only issue, and I'm really reluctant to speak beyond
okay.
that.
Representative Clark.
Mr. Chair, well, maybe we could hear from directly from the folks who have a concern.
We will have that. We're asking questions as witness first. I totally concur with you. We should. Anybody else? Well, thank you very much, Mr. Consimius.
Thank you for the
we appreciate your effort and your presentation. Mr. McKenzie, I believe. Welcome to the committee. Give your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm David McKenzie, and I'm here this morning in my capacity as chair of the Creating System Excellence Committee of the GWDC. In my other life, I'm also the director of the Hubert Humphrey Job Corps Center here in St. Paul. As Mr. Hale had mentioned earlier, the last legislative session commissioned the GWDC to look into the issue of, and I'm going to quote this, study the current configuration of workforce service areas in Minnesota and to see whether the efficiency or quality of service delivery could be improved by changing the boundaries of the workforce service areas or reducing the number of areas. As part of this study, the council shall develop recommendations for clarifying the governance role of the local workforce councils and strategies for improving the ability of the local workforce councils and local elected officials to oversee and manage an integrated service delivery system at the community level. We decided that the very first thing we needed to do in order to even have a hope to accomplish that mission was to get as many of the stakeholders as possible assembled on that committee. So we expanded the original Creating Systems Committee to include a bunch of other people, including some other members of the GWDC, local elected officials, DEED employees, members of the legislature and others, because we wanted to get as many voices heard as possible and obviously to find a way to get as much buy-in as we possibly could in the process. And so we met for about a 9-month period and discussed a number of things. We decided early on that we probably needed to separate the charge into two sections. One was to deal with the governance issue, and the other to look at the boundary issue. And we decided to tackle the governance issue first. We quickly discovered that to speak of a workforce development system is to speak pretty loosely in Minnesota because there's so many complexities around it. There's a variety of funding streams, federal and state. There's a variety of frameworks and structures that are in place. Some of them carry over from earlier workforce configurations under CETA and JTPA. WEA didn't help the matter much, in our opinion, by mandating a certain amount of local autonomy but not providing funding for that local autonomy. It got pretty complex pretty quickly. And if there's a theme in what we as a committee came up with, the theme is probably that we need as a state to work diligently and thoroughly to create as many partnerships and community sharing as we can possibly do. And I'll try to go through some of the details of that as I proceed. We also decided that we would not at this time make a specific recommendation about workforce service area boundaries because we discovered that too is fraught with a lot of complexities And we wanted to be sure that we were looking at not only efficiency but effectiveness. And some major discrepancies came up to us immediately when we looked at size versus population and the demographics of the state and the historical boundaries and all that. So I hope to get to that at the latter part of my presentation, but we did not make a specific recommendation at this time, as Mr. Hale had said. If we could look, I want to look at the specific recommendations that we made. Anybody who wants to follow along, this is on page 29 of the handout that you received. The first general category that we looked at was to establish and maintain relationships and communication between the various partners in the workforce service delivery process. And we recommended that the local workforce council should help to create a stronger connection between economic development, education, and workforce development efforts at the local level. We realize that all of those partners have an important role to play in this process, and we thought that the local workforce councils could serve as a convener, if nothing else, to bring those various viewpoints to the table. We also recommend that the local workforce council should work together on regional policy making initiatives that are not necessarily tied to WSA boundaries. Excuse me. We all know that the WSA boundaries are in a certain sense artificial, and that jobs and economic development flow across those boundaries in a variety of ways. So it was our recommendation that local workforce councils should be able to at least maximize the number of ways that those areas can cooperate, even if we didn't redraw WSA boundaries. We also recommend that Deed's role and relationship to the workforce center system should be clarified through written agreements with the local elected officials and local workforce councils. Deed has shown a great deal of willingness to cooperate in that regard through that process of the committee meetings and conversations elsewhere. We felt it was important that these relationships be written down as much as possible. Goodwill is wonderful, and we all hope that we all have it, but sometimes we need to rely on protocol to help establish lines of communication and responsibility, so that's one of our recommendations. Along with the same lines, we recommend that communication between Deed and the local workforce councils be strengthened through the development of a communications protocol for workforce center system decision making, so that the flow of information both from Deed to the local workforce councils and back is codified as much as possible, and so that there are requirements for reporting and dissemination of information. We recommend that Deed be allowed to have more funding flexibility for local level state staff to meet the local priorities identified by the local workforce councils through their regional planning efforts, and to encourage state local staff to use this funding for more to meet regional priorities. Funding issues are always a struggle, of course, and many of the dollars that flow into these programs are federal dollars that come earmarked specifically for specific efforts, but some of it is discretionary. We recommend that Deed and the local workforce councils should clarify and enforce current laws, rules, and practices that outline the role and function of the one-stop operating consortiums that govern the workforce centers. One of the things we discovered in a process of this was there was a great deal of confusion about a workforce service area versus a workforce center. And the workforce service area, of course, is a boundary that's drawn somewhat artificially, whereas a workforce service center is a place where the services are actually delivered, usually a building. We recommended finally under this category that Deed and the local workforce councils should work together to clarify the relationship between local level state staff and local workforce councils, including the development of set points of interaction between local level state staff and the LWCs. The second part of our general recommendations was to identify opportunities for continuous improvement in education, and we recommended that the Governor's Workforce Development Council should facilitate a process with the local workforce councils and Deed to assess the local workforce council's ability to play the three roles that we've defined, that they helped us to define actually, which is regional planning, workforce center system oversight, and WIA Title I planning and policy making. Number two, we recommend that local workforce councils and local elected officials should continue to reevaluate the composition of the local workforce council to ensure that that composition continues to meet the needs of the community, make sure that the people who are present, who need to be present. Number three, we recommend that DEED, the Governor Workforce Development Council, local elected officials, and local workforce councils should meet, work together to define the role of the Minnesota Workforce Council Association and the GWDC for providing support to the local workforce councils and providing local elected officials and local workforce councils with a venue to assert their leadership role at the state level. Again, we would hope that this is a process for creating partnerships and the flow of information and decision-making. We also recommend that DEED and the local workforce council should work together to develop a formalized process for evaluating the workforce center system based on the newly developed mission, vision, and principles for the workforce center system. And finally, under that category, we recommend that DEED should build on current efforts to strengthen data collection for the workforce development system and should develop a process for disseminating that data to the local workforce councils. This is obviously related to some of the earlier recommendations that we make. And finally, in the section C, we recommend that the strategies for connecting economic and workforce development, regional action plans should be developed by local partners and local workforce councils and other stakeholders to link economic and workforce development at the state and local levels. That one-stop operating consortium should work with local economic development partners and local workforce councils to develop employer services and to meet local needs. Number three, that metro area local workforce councils should begin working together to coordinate program planning and policy-making initiatives for job seeker and employer customers across WSA boundaries. And number four, Minnesota local workforce councils should ensure workforce center system planning and policy-making occurs at a local level for employer and job seeker services. As I stated, that you know, those are basically the recommendations that this committee was making with regard to the governance role of the local workforce councils. And as I said earlier, the theme that runs through this, I think, is finding ways to communicate better with all the partners, and that the local workforce councils can be conveners for that process, but they're also participants in it, along with DEED, which is the major player here. With regard to the analysis of WSA boundaries, we, as I stated earlier, we did not recommend right at this time that any specific changes be made. What we did is spend a lot of time trying to clarify what the real issues are. We tried to look at economic efficiency as well as effectiveness. We tried to create a template, in other words, to do a thorough analysis. We wanted to make sure that we didn't just look at the easy solution, which was probably to say, well, of course it's cheaper to have fewer workforce service areas, and it might be. But we wanted to be sure that we looked at all the elements that are important in deciding that. So we created what I hope is a good template for continuing that analysis. We recommend that the Governor Workforce Development Council should lead a process for continuing to review the WSA boundaries, and that process should include chief elected officials, GWDC members, the governor, and local workforce council chairs. And that it's our hope to deliver a recommendation on those to the governor for inclusion in the plan that has to be done for 2005. So that concludes the formal testimony. I'll be welcome to try my best to answer any questions that anybody might have.
Looking forward to your recommendations to the governor. Is there any questions of this witness? Well, we appreciate all the work you've done, and we look forward, like I said, to seeing what happens when we get a report to the governor. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman.
I think we have several. I think on the first report, we probably should go ask from the audience if there's anybody that would like to testify. I kind of figured that. Don Gertesmeyer, please come on up.
I'd like to bring Gene online.
Very well. No video solitaire. Welcome to the committee. Give your name for the record.
Morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Don Gertesmeyer, and I work for the Minnesota Teamsters, and I'm involved with Teamsters Service Bureau. I'd just like to comment quickly on the recommendation of the ad hoc committee, and the reason that we don't have a formal reply is these issues, I think, first formally came up at the last GWDC full council meeting. Some of the members of this committee were at that meeting, and they ran into a lot of opposition, two or three of the specific recommendations of the six that are in front of you. At that time, there wasn't consensus to pass those, and they were sent on to the ad hoc committee. and that is the recommendations that you have in front of you. And the committee and Mr. Hale have accurately reflected, you know, that there isn't there is some opposition to these things. So you have those in front of you. The full Governor's Workforce Development Council doesn't meet again until March 17th, I believe it is. So we haven't had a chance to look at these, but we have had an ongoing conversation with the staff and the commissioner and the people at DEED. We think that we were in some area of agreement on some of the things that are before you that we would be glad to answer whatever questions we can. We understand that the department's recommendations to the governor will come out today. So we need to see those before we can respond to you as to where our position is on these matters. So I am very grateful to get an opportunity to address you briefly this morning so that you understand that not presenting you something formally or not being given a chance to step up here and tell you there is some disagreement on some of the issues. The rapid response, the raising the number from 50 to 200, the training piece, and they all are being worked on and may or may not be coming out today in full agreement. I can't tell you until we see them. But I do want you to be aware that the community has some very large concerns. And one thing I want you to be aware of as we move through this, watch for the words universal customer or variations of that. What we're discussing is a dislocated worker program, a dislocated worker tax. It's not designed to do other things fairly to the employer that pays this tax. And the chamber has a great deal of problem with it from time to time. But if we deviate and start using it for something other, I believe there's been $60-some million taken out of this fund for the general fund, and if all of us agree to do something else with this money other than treat and train dislocated workers, there's going to be some huge problems with this thing. But anyway, thank you. Gene Dunn may have a few remarks, and otherwise we'd be glad to answer whatever questions we can.
Well, I have to also give you an apology. I didn't know when we just talked last time that we were going to have this day.
That's okay.
And I'm sorry I didn't give you any more warning than you got.
Uh-huh. Okay.
I appreciate you coming here.
Thank you. My name is Jean Dunn. I'm the executive director of the Minnesota Teamster Service Bureau. We're one of two independent grantees who serve the state of Minnesota through the Dislocated Worker Program and also a certified provider. And I was a member of this ad hoc committee who did this study and was, I think, kindly referenced as the dissenting vote often by Mr. Konzimias. This really has been a moving target, and I just have to start by saying that. The recommendations that you have in front of you, there are some that are easily agreed to in terms of some administrative and reporting kinds of functions that everybody is in agreement ought to be worked on and are more department level than legislative level. But some of the others have grave outcomes for the dislocated worker program, and there was a lot of conflict over the discussion of those, and I don't think that these proposals that you are seeing in front of you, the one about moving the number from 50 to 200 to define a program or a project, or the one talking about changing the amount of training available, will be part of the department's legislative strategy. I don't know for sure. We'll know more today. But as I say, over the course of time, we keep hearing different things about what's coming forward. But I do want to say a couple of things about that most disturbing of recommendations, and that is changing the definition of a project from 50 to 200. And as a committee member, I can tell you that this was an 11th hour proposal. This came up at the last meeting. There really wasn't a great deal of time for discussion about it, and there were strong dissenting votes, but we were outvoted. And so it comes to be in your report. And I would like to address a question that was given to Mr. Konzimias about what was the dissent about that. And really the dissent was around access to services. We've been doing this program for 17 years. And we initially, this program was only about projects. The only way people accessed services was when there was an identified community impact and the whole group of people were treated as one group moving through the process and getting services. There was recognition years later that individuals also were suffering as dislocated workers, and they should have some access to the services as well. But the original intent always was about the greater impact, the group that was undergoing a large layoff or a mass, you know, a closing or a mass layoff. And so our experience has been that when you can work with people in a group, whether it's 50 or initially it was 25, whether it's 25 or 50, the experience that those people have is much more positive because we can come out to their location, we can deliver services on site. Often we're able to deliver services to the extent that when they actually are finally laid off from that company, they're going right directly to the next job. And so 70 to 80% of people in a project level activity will receive services. And yet we know that from an independent study ordered many years ago by the Department of Economic Security at that point, that only about 20% of eligible dislocated workers access services. So you can see the disparity and the impact of the utilization of funds by individuals. They simply can't find their way through the morass to get to the services. And certainly that holds down the demand on service, but I don't think that was the intent of this program. We really want to be able to assist Minnesota's workers who built this economy and through no fault of their own have lost their jobs, they've disappeared, they have obsolete skills. And to kind of dissipate this fund into a totally formula program that goes to the workforce service areas and eventually to the workforce service centers, it doesn't really meet the mandate of the original program. Even Mr. McKenzie talked to you about his report on the workforce service areas and the fact that there are these unfunded mandates that we have brought forward. We don't disagree about that. We know that the workforce centers are suffering from a need to perform without getting the required, you know, financial support to do it. But we are strongly opposed to using the dislocated worker money to make up that gap. And we're very much afraid that that's what this process will entail. And then just one final comment on your report. On page 13 on recommendation C, in the column that kind of gives the commentary, it talks about the 50% of expenditures going towards training. I just want to clarify that the 50% mandate for training on a dislocated worker project is that the overall budget, 50% of that money is to be spent on training. Now, we can talk about waivers and all that, but that's not my point right here. The point here is that this language seems to infer that for every dislocated worker, of all the funds spent on that individual worker, 50% has to be for training. That's not the case. We have people come through a project who receive no training, and we have people who come through a project who receive a lot of training. But at the end of the day, at the final accounting of that project, unless we've asked for a waiver, 50% of the fund is spent on training that particular group of dislocated workers. And that's different than what the language here says. So it's an important distinction to keep in mind.
Mr. Gerdes.
Mr. Chairman, let me quickly conclude, though, and see if I can put a face on this for you. And Gene will have to help me a little bit with this. Fairway Foods closed in Northfield about 300 Teamster warehousemen and drivers. Now, with no project, they have to find their own way. They have to find a way to work for a center system, whatever, find a way into the system, get help. There was a project. We were awarded that project. Gene opened an office in Northfield, and I believe we were there virtually 24 hours a day to help these people as they came off shifts, as the plant's getting ready to close, to get up to speed and get them going faster than them having to find their own way through the system. That's the problem with going to 200, is anything under 200, they have to find their own way through the system. And that's one of the most traumatic events of our life. We know that, losing your job. So we believe that's just the dead wrong way to go, is raising that to 200. But anyway, we think maybe we have some agreement on that. Hopefully we won't be back in front of you, that everything that comes out today, we can find a way to work with and make a recommendation to the governor, but we'll see. But anyway, thank you for an opportunity this morning.
Thank
you. Be glad to answer any questions.
Any questions? Mr. Linder.
Mr. Chair, you mentioned that only 20% of the dislocated workers seek help. Do you think that might be because they're planning on just taking some time off if they're laid off and they got 6 months unemployment coming, or years, that might be one of the reasons?
Representative Linder, Mr. Chair, that a very small percentage of people, perhaps, but they would eventually find their way to a dislocated worker program and be counted. They just didn't come right at the date of layoff. More often, it's lack of knowledge. They just don't know it's available. There's also a sense of this being a, you know, some kind of government program they don't want to take advantage of. They don't understand that this is money that's been set aside for this particular event in their lives. That part of their you know, work history has contributed to create the fund. And so there's a need to help educate people about why this fund exists, why they ought to take advantage of it, and why it's there for them. I think some of the other reasons that people don't ever come into a dislocated worker program are they retire, they don't need it, they walked out the door, they found another job. They are not people who like to receive services and are just going to kind of go it alone. They move, they die, they have health reasons that they can't participate.
Mm-hmm. Representative Linder.
Mr. Chair and Jean, I didn't get your last name, so
that's
I'll
fine.
Just call you Jean.
That's fine. Thank you.
I don't know, it's been my experience that probably 90% of the people laid off, you know, are going to take some time off. They see it as an opportunity to take a little time off and do whatever they want to do. But you see a lot more people than I do. You know, I just know from two or three business experiences and some relatives.
Yeah.
Some close friends that have done this. So I know it a little bit firsthand. I just wanted to see, you know, how you felt about that, because 20% seems like a low number seeking services when we spend so much money on this, and practically every business you go into, every shop and so forth, they have a bulletin board that has all of this information about where they can get help, and you say you go out to the job site, you distribute literature on how they can find help, and it just seems strange that there'd just be 20% seeking help right away.
I think it would be kind of helpful for me, before we get Representative Sertich, if you would describe, in your opinion, what you think the typical dislocated worker, who is this person? Are they a person that has had a work history for 10 years? Is it a person that is got a skill level that is higher than the average worker? Can you kind of describe this person to me?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, thank you. The targeted dislocated worker is someone who has an established commitment to the workforce. Doesn't mean that he's maybe been with that particular employer for 10 years, but he has been a contributing member to the workforce in the same kind of industrial capacity, and reaches a point where those kinds of skills are no longer necessary in the local economy and needs to have a skill change, or sometimes the best thing we do for people is help them look at what really went into the work that they did. A worker who's been long-term in the workplace gets to the point where they just see the work they did as defining the skills that they have, when there really are a plethora of skills that go into enabling them to do the job they actually did. So we help them identify what those skills are, and sometimes those skills, with just a little brushing up, can be transferable to a new industry that individual might never have thought of. But by and large, these are people who have an established commitment to the workforce, have skills that are outdated, obsolete, no longer in demand.
Okay.
And they're male, female, they're of every racial and ethnic background, and you asked about skill level. Some of them are low skill leveled, and there is some debate right now about should we be training people with low skills since there are so many low-skilled jobs available. And that, you know, I'm willing to engage in that debate. My estimation, in a perfect world, yeah. You know, if we can help them move up the ladder, I think we should be. But we also have high-skilled dislocated workers. We have, as you well know, airline pilots. You know, some very highly technical skills. But they're, you know, there's not enough airline pilot jobs any longer. And so do we wait for the airline industry to rebound and let these people just kind of be out there taking low-skill, low-wage jobs until that rebound happens? I don't happen to think so. I think if there's a way to give them some short-term training, and again, remembering that this program is not geared to four-year training programs or three-year training programs. At very best, you're looking at maybe 2 years, unless there's a federal impact and you have a trade adjustment act, Trade Adjustment Act influence, where they can get additional training and additional subsidies in the manner of extended unemployment so that they can afford to continue in school. By and large, we're not talking about training programs that are any longer. I think the average dislocated worker training program, and I'd have to check this out for sure, but I'm thinking it's about 9 to 10 months. It isn't everybody who goes for 2 years, even though that does happen from time to time. So it is a variety of skill levels at this point, and the debate continues about should that be changed.
Okay. Representative Sertich.
Mr. Chairman, I defer to Representative Clark for a second.
Representative Clark.
Something on this point.
Yeah. Actually, I have two questions. One that just came from your recent testimony. I know until this recent layoff of a lot more skilled workers, it seems to me, if I recall right, the portrait of what a dislocated worker might look like in Minnesota was pretty often a middle-aged woman in disproportion to others, and I don't know if that's changed very much, but pretty often we're talking about, you know, the lower skilled or sometimes very highly skilled women being laid off. Is that still, is there a disproportionate gender impact still?
I don't think so, Representative Clark, Mr. Chair. I don't think it's necessarily as disproportionate as it once was.
Okay.
But it's probably still, I can't really answer.
Okay.
I don't know that.
That's okay.
Yeah.
Mr. Chair, I guess the original question I had is, and it goes back to maybe one of the questions Representative Lindner raised about the low participation rate. My understanding is when you go to a site, you get much more participation in that sort of outreach.
Absolutely.
But one thing, a person isn't alone and think it's their own personal problem. They identify with a whole group of people. And I think the other thing I'd like to have you comment on, if you may tell me if that's true and if you know any percentages difference there in terms of that sort of outreach. But also, the dynamic has to be somewhat different when you have a group of people working together on getting retraining than when you have an individual person by themselves going. And I'm just wondering if you could talk about how that works in terms of success rate or not.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair, Representative Clark, that's absolutely true. When we go out to a plant-specific project, if we have enough time and are able to work with people 30 to 60 days before they walk out the door, we'll have about 90% participation rate. And we're doing workshops on site, so people are being able to access things about career assessments and what do their skills look like now, what getting information about the local labor market and where are they going to fit. They get information about training. Sometimes they're able to access training while they're still working because they can take it at night or vice versa. And the important part of a plant-specific project is the formation of an employee management committee, and that committee is elected from the affected workforce to represent them in making some very important decisions about how to customize this program for their specific needs. That it's called an EMC, and they get together and they actually format out a list of recommendations or things that they want to see in their program provider and ask all of us who want to come in and provide those services, how can you best address this for our group? And then they hire us. They are essentially our employer for that year or year and a half, 2 years, while we provide them with the services that they've told us will best fit the needs of this workforce. And the strength of that is that EMC knows intimately the needs of every individual worker there. They have worked together for a long time. They know those people who are going to be reticent about coming forward and saying that they have support service needs or mental health needs or family needs and can reach out to them. Equally importantly, they're there to help us as a service provider troubleshoot problem areas for workers. You can imagine as an individual person, as you go into a workforce center that you're not familiar with and you're hearing language you're not familiar with, it's not easy to be daunted. I mean, it's not hard to get daunted by that kind of language and just drop out of the system because you don't understand what's going on. In a project with that EMC in place, people can go to them and say, I don't know what this vocational counselor is talking about. I don't know how I fit into this process. And we can help solve that problem and communicate in a way that's most effective for those workers. And so the success rate of early placement and return to work is much higher in a project than it is through the formula programs and in terms of total numbers of people. I'm not trying to say that people who come into a formula program aren't served well and don't succeed well. It's just the sheer numbers of people who will not continue through the process because they don't understand how to make it work for themselves is much larger in the formula side than it is in the project side.
Anything? Representative Sertich.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I know you talked about a study that was done kind of still to this point where 20% participation. I think you said that study was a bit old, that is. And I'm assuming that the Lindner study that you were talking about, Representative, was quite unofficial. That 10% of your family and friends are just kind of hanging out and taking some time off. I do know that there was a study done on the LTV layoffs and the very quick success rate of those folks getting retrained and back employed and not just sitting around collecting checks. So I'm wondering if Deed, somewhere along the line here, can maybe provide us with some more recent information on this. But my question more goes to to Deed as well. If they're coming out with some recommendations today, is this embargoed? Can we talk about it? Maybe if Deed's here, I mean, we can move the process along and say, hey, what's their recommendations? It concerns me a bit I'm assuming that they're going to be close to his own counsel's recommendations. It concerns me, though, that some of these recommendations came at the last hour and maybe weren't as well thought out. But I hope there's not a surprise here. Maybe we can...
I think this process is going through at least its third evolution.
Mm-hmm.
And we certainly have some governmental affairs people from Deed up there that I'm sure could love to add some light to your.
Well, if it's a secret, I'm cool with that. But if they want to tell us, well, it might help.
I guarantee you, if I told you, I wouldn't have to kill you. We appreciate your testimony. We'll look forward to more.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the
committee. Or not.
Would you have something you want to bring up? And then we'll have Larry Greenbaum come up next, and then we have a bill we have to work on, Representative Clark's bill. And she said she could get through in the last 20 minutes, so we got to go for that target. Although she did ask the bulk of the question.
I'll be very brief, John Rakowski with Deed, and to answer Representative Sertich's query about is this a secret, is this embargoed? No. The Job Skills Partnership Board, which the committee is very familiar with, is meeting today at 1 o'clock and will discuss these proposals. Therefore, we haven't gone forward with any legislation until after the meeting. So that's my statement.
Very well.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Thanks, Mr. Rakowski.
I'm sure you won't be the last one to know. with that, Mr. Greenbaum, come on down. We'd love to hear your spin on this. And thank you very much, Mr. Rakowski.
You're welcome, Mr. Chairman.
Welcome to the committee. Give your name for the
record.
Thank you,
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Larry Greenbaum. I'm the director of JVS, Jewish Vocational Service, which is a division of the Jewish Family and Children's Service of Minneapolis. And I would like to tell you a bit about our dislocated worker program and go to some of the issues that you've just been discussing. This past year in 2003, JVS served 1,400 dislocated workers and reemployed 800 of those people at average hourly wages of $18.59 an hour. That materializes $31 million in entry wages that those people put back into the economy in 1 year, which is $31 million compared with $1.5 million that we spent in revenue that was provided through the program. So the program generated a cost-benefit ratio of 20 to 1. That's not bad. Now, why is that? Why did we succeed this way? I think it's because we have a mindedness, as Gene Dunn does in the Teamsters Service Bureau and other certified providers, private certified providers, to who the customers are and what our mission is. I see three customers: the dislocated workers, people who have to get back to work quickly, the employers that have lost those employees. They have paid the fee for the dislocated worker program, and we're representing them and being responsible to their former employees and helping them to avoid liability for unemployment costs and so forth. And the third customer is the state of Minnesota. And that's also very important because we're turning money back into the state, rebuilding the economy, all together at the same time. Now, in my opinion, my name was listed on the study, on the first page, as a bystander in the peanut gallery. And I was not on the committee. But I want to tell you that I do not subscribe to the recommendations of the study. Okay, another dissenting opinion. Okay, I believe that the study recommendations will not create greater efficiency of the program, but may dismantle the program, will certainly harm the program. Why? The people indeed would have us believe, and I agree with this part, that competition is the core to success in this thing. And it is. Gene just mentioned to you about the EMCs and how in mass layoffs workers choose their own providers. This is so key to the success of this thing, and the JVS program depends on it because it is the only resource we have at JVS to provide dislocated worker services. So our success goes away if your money goes to the WSAs. Now, right now, the WSAs receive about 50% of the state money for dislocated worker services anyway. I think the bill says 35 to 50% today. The other 50% is held over for mass layoffs. Do you want to give that away? If you give that away, what opportunity does the state have as a customer in the case of an emergency to be responsive? What opportunity does the governor have to be responsible to emergencies and communities in the state? LTV was used as an example. There are 305 other examples in 2003. But So I really implore you to go on the side of competitive mandate and realize that saying that you give the money to the WSAs is not a competitive process, but it's talking out of both sides of your mouth. Because it sounds on one hand that, well, let's turn the money back to the locals where it belongs because they know who the workers are more than anybody else does. But that's not what's happening. What's happening is the money is being sent down to the locals to plug deficits in the WSAs and in the workforce centers at the cost of the dislocated worker program. I call it feather bedding. There's terms that have been used here a few minutes ago, like universal customer, and that's kind of hype for let's try to get everybody in the program that we can at the WSAs. But it's really a mechanism to bring in the $12.5 million that's left out of the $25 million in the program for mass layoffs to cushion the fiscal problems at the WSAs. So I have a real problem with this thing. I really believe that we're a dedicated player to it. I want to stay a dedicated player to it. And basically, that's where I'm coming from. Thank you very much.
We appreciate your comments. Speaking of WSAs, I think we have Jerry Vitsum, I think, would like to have a few statement questions. We want to start listening to Karen, Representative Clarksville, at 22, so kind of judge your time accordingly. I think, Representative Osterman, you still have a question. I'm sorry. I Lynn, do you still have?
I do.
Okay, go ahead.
No, I can wait till.
Okay. You were on the committee also. We can't wait to your comments. We'd love to hear them. Mr.
Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Jerry Vidson. I direct the Anoka County Workforce Center. And here on behalf of the Workforce Council Association, just to mention a couple words, I was on the committee. And I just like to make a couple of points. I think the issues that you're hearing a lot today have mostly to do with a lack of resources, for some, particularly for the small project layoffs. One of the pieces of information we looked at is that about 80 to 84% of the layoffs occur in small layoffs, under 50. And we have a further complicating factor that even when it is 50 or over, employers, as was mentioned by Mr. Konzemius, often lay off in smaller quantities. So these folks show up at the workforce centers, and because of the high demand the past couple of years, there's been a real shortage of money. We've been trying to, you know, ration that out. And I think the concern of many on the committee, myself included, was that we kind of have one set of services for people that are from large layoffs, and we have another set of services for people from small, and the small aren't getting kind of their share of the resources, and that's really the main concern. And I think most of the stuff that was talked about was trying to make that more equitable, and there's a lot of ways to do it. The 50 to 200 was one. It's one the committee recommended. I think the department is trying to work on some other options, and hopefully we can come up with something that people can agree to. But I think that's basically the issue. It's an issue of consistency, people showing up, not being able to get service at the workforce centers, and we're trying to even that out. And that proposal was one of them, but it's not the only one.
Very well. Any questions? Representative Osterman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess what I just wanted to revisit with my colleagues here is something that we talked about in the committee when we talked about this proposal. And I just wanted to be reminded of some numbers, if I could, from staff. Just now, the gentleman prior to you mentioned that there were 305 examples in 2003. Did we have that many layoffs over 50 that would have been served? Is that, where, what was that number that he just said? That seemed really high to me. My original question to the staff was, what is the difference between 50 and 200 in terms of real opportunities to serve? What is the likelihood, like how many layoffs would fall in that category from the past year? That was one to two of those. We did talk, and this again is just for our information moving forward. We talked about the possibility of a layoff of 50 in one community is a big layoff, and a layoff of 200 in the Twin Cities maybe is something that isn't as noticeable. And so I remember in discussions us talking about some sort of a tiered analysis, if you will, and that's the piece that I think maybe I as a committee member missed, if we got feedback on that. Can you speak to that from staff? Because I think it gets really to the heart and soul of what our folks that have been testifying, the dissenters, are trying to bring to our attention thoughtfully, and that is that you know, maybe it's not a one-size-fits-all type of a situation. And I think we need to kind of get back to that discussion. And I know that's not for the rest of today's hearing, mm-hmm. but if maybe we could just have staff talk about what happened to that tiered analysis issue.
I think, Luke, would you like to come up? Thank you, Mr. Vidson. Welcome to committee. Give your name for the record.
Thanks. I'm Luke Weisberg. I'm the staff director for the Governor's Workforce Development Council. Mr. Chair, Representative Osterman, the discussion that you're referring to happened at the January full council meeting where when the council reviewed the initial recommendations for the dislocated worker study, there was some discussion at the January meeting about rather than having a fixed number, 50, 200, something in between, what if there were some type of impact analysis that would get at the issue that you're raising? And the council's direction at the January meeting was to ask the ad hoc committee that was completing the work to consider that. And so at the following meeting, I believe it was the last meeting, in fact, of the ad hoc committee, we did look at a couple ways of doing an analysis like that. And I've got those numbers. In fact, I think they're on our website. And I'd be happy to make them available to committee members if you're interested. Mm-hmm. The ad hoc committee did consider that, looked at a couple different ways of doing it, didn't agree on any one, and so therefore it didn't show up in the final report. But there are certainly ways of doing that, and the final recommendation in the report suggests that there's some additional flexibility there if indeed there was a move to go from 50 to 200. But if it if at a later point the committee wants to see some of those numbers, we can certainly bring them back and talk through them with everyone.
Just one more.
Representative Wolfstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this is not. I mean, I know that we have to make, we have to move forward with something out of this probably, but I do think that there would be some merit in revisiting recommendation F, because clearly, as our service providers are trying to provide that service and be good partners to us, if they have some issues about, you know, what happens on the front line with these dollars, I think we have to be responsive to those concerns. And I just would like to share again with my colleagues that I did express at that meeting that it felt like 200 was a very arbitrary number, and I would have liked to have seen more analysis about that number. I mean, maybe it should be 400. I'm being sarcastic, but we don't really have a justification at this point in time to go to the 200, so I would just like us to have more consideration on that.
I can't wait to see the department's recommendation.
Right.
No, I won't. With that, I appreciate all the discussion. I appreciate the Governor's Workforce Council doing all the work, and their staff does wonderful work. And that will go to Representative Clark's bill. All those people with the yellow buttons on, this is your time. Welcome to your committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We'll get right to it because there are a number of people who would like to testify. Basically, committee members, the bill before you is to restore the 30% cut that happened to these two important programs for our people who are dealing with homelessness issues in the state of Minnesota, the transitional housing and the emergency services. 30% is the amount that was cut last year when we were dealing with budget cuts at a time of record high homelessness in the state of Minnesota. So this bill would simply restore it, and I think be very complementary to what the governor's long-term vision is. This is to deal with the immediate crisis right now. And I'm going to turn immediately to Michael Bell, who is going to provide some information, and then we do have a number of people who would like to testify, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, good morning. My name is Michael Dahl, and I'm the Executive Director for the Minnesota Coalition for the Homeless. The Coalition's mission is to end homelessness. And we know that we can do that by getting enough flexible resources so that each community can design an affordable housing and homelessness response system to meet its needs. We are happy that there is so much attention this session to dealing with homelessness issues, and I want to talk with you about a couple of different approaches. Both were brought to light by Governor Pawlenty at a press conference he held on January 7th. On January 7th, the governor stated that he wanted to end long-term homelessness by 2010. I share that goal, and I think that many of the people in this room share that goal as well. There are many reasons he stated we need to meet that objective. Just a few were, there are far too many vulnerable people who can't get help. It's costing us too much to keep the system operating the way it is. And we have the tools to actually solve the problem. Just quickly, there's 5,000 individuals that were identified who are long-term homeless. We're paying for it through emergency rooms, detox centers, corrections facilities, property tax dollars that are paying to manage this crisis. And we have good permanent supportive housing programs in place to make sure, or that could be developed to address the problem. On January 7th, the governor also stated another goal. He said that he wanted to fill the cracks so that when that 2010 timeline rolled around and we've helped the 5,000 individuals who are currently long-term homeless, there aren't a whole new group of people who have come to fill that place. I also share that goal, and that's what this bill is just a small part about. I share that goal for the same reasons, because there are far too many vulnerable people who are costing far too much, both in human and financial terms, to be maintained in a system that isn't working for them, and that we do have the tools to address the problem. This Friday, we're going to get some new figures from Wilder Research Center, so I don't want to get too bogged down in the statistics that are going to change pretty quickly. But we know that there are 7,000 people who still get into shelter each night. We know that there are still 1,000 people who get turned away every night. That number is likely to grow unless we get this bill passed, because service providers have been doing all they can to raise private funds to fill the gap, and they're telling us that they're near the end of any sort of assistance they can get to address that need, and they'll have to cut beds, they'll have to close shelters, they'll have to close transitional housing programs. We have, just really quickly, a third of single mothers are homeless because of domestic abuse. Half of those who are homeless are children. Unaccompanied youth becoming prey to pimps and drug dealers because we have a system that doesn't work. Now, we have the tools that can help folks out. We have shelter that can help them transition into transitional housing or permanent supportive housing. We have assistance programs that are very effective at helping those we can get to. What would we think if we didn't provide the resources to solve this problem when we knew that we could, especially when we have the governor putting highlight on this issue right now? We absolutely need to do to restore at least the money that we lost last year, and then next year take a look at how we can go further. So where do we stand today? As Representative Clark said, we had a 30% cut in shelter and transitional housing resources, $2.7 million that were lost. I have plenty of examples of shelter of shelters that have closed or had to reduce beds, and we'll have some folks testify about that. It's having a tremendous impact in the community. Now, we need a long-term plan to address this problem, and the governor's efforts are part of that. This is a picture of a camp, and I'm going to pass this around. That's a picture of a camp who someone who can't get into shelter. Suffered from chemical dependency problems, severe and persistent mental illness, who would be a prime candidate for the housing that the governor is saying we need to bring on in about that will take a while to get sited and built. It'll be available, hopefully, in the next few years. The man who stayed in that camp, his name is Robin Sam, and he died. He died, I think it was just a little over a week ago. He burned to death when he had a fire to try to keep warm during the cold days. And we couldn't get help to him quickly enough. This is part of the tarp that you see in that picture. Robin Sam needed help today. So we're asking that you restore the shelter money because until we get those units built, we need to have something that helps him now. And this $2.7 million just helps it so that we're only turning 1,000 people away each night. I have a number of people who want to testify, have some hard examples for why this money is needed. And so I'm going to turn it over to them, and then hopefully if there's questions towards the end, we can take those.
Thank you, Mr. Dahl. Next on the list, we have Monica Nielsen from the Simpson Housing. Ms. Nielsen, welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Good morning, committee members. My name is Monica Nielsen, and I am shelter director at Simpson Housing Services. We have 50 families in scattered site housing and operate two emergency shelters for men and women in church basements that contain rows of mats on the floor. You may obtain a bed either by depositing 40% of your income with us to save toward housing or by entering our lottery. Last night, like every Monday night at the lottery, you would be given a number, and if your number is drawn, you can stay for a month. If not, you must leave. Now, some would say that's so cold and random, but I ask you, which of you would like the job of deciding who can sleep inside tonight? I thought one thing I could offer you is some notes from a night at the lottery. While they may be chaotic or make you uncomfortable, it is the truth of what I see. I've titled it Barbecue Skewers and 13-Hour Sales. 6 p.m., opening time. Check that all the mats are laid out on the floor. Move one to the snoring section. Joe was outside. Phone, take first name for the women's shelter. Get the door. 1, 2, 3, 56, 57, 58, 627. Phone, sorry, the women's shelter is full. Door, 112, 113, 114. It's gotten busier since we closed 100 beds last year after the funding cuts. Phone, I'm sorry, the women's shelter is full. Yes, we have army blankets to sleep outside with. You can pick one up here. Kate would like to join the savings program. She has 40% of her paycheck and starts to explain herself, but the line backs up outside, so I ask her to go find Madeline. Helen is a senior who has been living here for 4 months waiting to get into public housing. She gives me $200 or 40% of her monthly income of $500 so that she qualifies for a mat on the floor. Wendy is 18. She has her homework spread out on her mat. She's a senior in a Minneapolis high school. 7:15. I meet with Rita. I ask her how she can keep her job at the hospital while she is going through chemotherapy. She tells me she isn't working, but people at the hospital are donating their time off so that she may keep her job and her insurance. I tell people to gather in the dining room for the lottery. Dominic says I have such big eyes. I say thanks dismissively. He then suggests that perhaps I have a thyroid condition. 7:30, start the lottery. A volunteer pulls numbers written on index cards from a grocery bag. Tom wins, Jose wins, Clarence wins. Name after name is drawn for a 28-day mat. A man with schizophrenia thinks we're cheating. I reassure him that we can't feel the difference between the yellow index cards and the white ones in the bag. The lottery is over. A man comes over and whispers in my ear, "Why don't you give my bed to that guy over there? He looks like he needs it more than me." I realize the kid in the blue shirt is 16. His mom won a bed, but he lost. Stan goes to the dining room and offers his highest compliments to tonight's meal servers. "Now that," he says, "that was a $7 meal." Phone, "Sorry, the lottery is over. Come next week." Jenny is leaving. I tell her I worry about her sleeping in her truck in the woods. "Don't worry," she comforts me. "I've got my barbecue skewers to protect me." 8 o'clock. Door. It's a couple named Mary and Joseph. "I'm sorry, we're full. You can't come in." Ironic how such unchristian words are spoken most often in a church doorway. I've also had to turn away someone named Bethlehem. Tom is waiting for the ironing board. He has to get up at 4 a.m. to catch a bus to Minnetonka to catch a ride to work. Mornings are always busy at Krispy Kreme in Maple Grove. He asks Sarah to hurry up, but Sarah pays no attention. She has to be in Edina early, too. Tomorrow's the 13-hour sale. I bring 16-year-old Mark and his mom, Pamela, into the office. Mark was living with his dad in Henderson until he died last Thursday. Even if I had a bed for him, he's too young to stay here, so they'll both go. Luis asks for all his money. He's found an apartment in Invergrove Heights. He shakes everybody's hands and says thank you. He reminds us to stop by Appliances at Sears on Rice Street sometime and say hi. I pass by John as he's telling Patrick that he is Jesus Christ and that Monica is going to marry him. Patrick responds that he didn't realize Jesus dated. 9 o'clock, Kristen calls from the women's shelter. They're full, and St. Francis Hospital in Shakopee wants to cab over someone with a feeding tube. Staff will take her and see if they can help her with the gagging. I wonder if she will know the streets of Minneapolis when the shelter closes at 7 a.m. When Margaret came in, she signed her Social Security number 000000001. I said she is either mentally ill or very, very old. Either way, she can stay. 10 o'clock, I leave to go home. I walk down the sidewalk, passing David and Kate sleeping in the first church door, Ray in the bushes, Mr. and Mrs. Gomez in door number 2, and Wally in door number 3. I wonder if I should kick them out so that you will not be uncomfortable at the sight of them. Then I remember that someone once told me that it's my job to comfort the afflicted and afflict the comfortable. I keep walking. The car parked next to mine is fogged up. Pamela waves goodnight from the front seat of her car. Her son Mark rolls down the window and wishes me a good night from the back seat. What will the restoration of $2.7 million in emergency shelter and transitional housing funding do? It will mean that Helen, a senior, won't have to put a folding chair next to her mat on the floor to get out of bed every morning. It will mean a hospital worker who happens to be homeless and going through chemotherapy can gain stability and reduce her health care costs. It will mean that you will get good service when you shop at Sears from a housed, rested worker. And it will mean Wendy could have a stable place to do her homework and actually graduate from high school. I only wish that I could have you with me when I have a room full of people looking at me, hoping that I've pulled their number. We need you to have the courage to go to leadership and ask to find this funding. I won't give up if you don't give up.
Thank you. Next on the list is Chuck Phoenix from the Dorothy Day Center.
Thank you. My name is Chuck Phoenix. I use the Dorothy Day drop-in center and shelter at night, and I've been volunteering there for a year and a half. First of all, I'd like to pay my respect to Representative Clark here. She's always been there for hardworking people in South Minneapolis who feel like it's up to them to make this world a little bit better place than they found it. 32 years ago, a group of us started in the Phillips neighborhood, got together and started the third food co-op in Minneapolis, presently known as Mill City Foods. One of those people was me. I'm here talking to you about homeless shelters. The other is the executive director of the Greater Minnesota Housing Fund. Such is life. Let me describe to you for a minute the routine at Dorothy Day Center, where we take a drop-in center that serves 300 meals at lunch and transforms it into a shelter for people at night, numbering anywhere from 150 to 175. An hour before we open up at 8:30, 6 to 8 volunteers come in and commence to set up the shelter. That includes rearranging the dining room to separate the women's space. We usually have 15 to 20 women stay every night. That includes bringing down the bagged blankets from upstairs. We have 200 blankets that we separate in a room alphabetically. That includes taking the mats out of another room and making them stacking them up and making them available. Some other volunteers check the donated food that's been donated for the shelter that night and set that out on a table. At 8:30, we open up. We have lights out at 10 o'clock, so between 8:30 and 10, people get to come in, put their masks down, get their blankets, make up their bed, grab a bite to eat, and either go to sleep or visit with their next door neighbor. A lot of interaction goes on between the staff and the people that come in. These people have been on the street all day. They've been in the drop-in center. And the amount of interaction that goes on is really important. I'll get to that in a minute. 10 o'clock, lights out. Some people have permission from work to come in late at night after the shelter closes, but if you don't have that permission, you can't come in. The next morning, we have lights on at 6 o'clock, and people get up, they put up their blankets in their bags, they put their mats up, they get the dress, do the toiletry they have to do, and all this is done in 30 minutes. During the winter time, the staff has volunteered their time so that people can stay till 7:30 and stay out of the cold for a while. But at 7:30, everyone has to leave. And the volunteers that set up the shelter began to tear it down, clean up the dining room so 300 meals can be served at lunch, and clean up the and straighten up the drop-in center to service the people that are coming in, and put up the blankets and put up the mats. These are the same people that just got through spending the night in the shelter. And this is a process that goes on every night. And one thing I want to stress, and must not describe the routine to you, but try to put a face on, importantly, the people that come in there. I think Monica did an excellent job. I really feel humbled being here with the people like Monica, the people from the Coalition for the Homeless, John Petroskis, and the work he's done to help the homeless. The people that are real soldiers, working every day to relate to a problem that just escapes the attention of a lot of people. The people that come in our shelter are all types. We have mental illness, we have people with borderline psychosis, we have chemically dependent people. We have people that have just come into town and lost a job in outstate Minnesota, or people that just lost a job, people that are suffering from domestic abuse, people that are escaping a abusive home life. Every night there's a different mix of people. Some nights, quite a volatile mix. But this is the last resort for people to go. Otherwise, they're out on the street, they're in the doorways, they're in the parks, they're down by the river. They're wherever they can find a place to lay down, or at least to escape detection. I think that what often gets overlooked is the important socialization. That might sound like a strange word to use, but it really is important to understand the little, the great benefit a little amount of time can mean to these people, to come in, interact with staff, to interact with people that are in the same boat they are for a little while, to realize that maybe they're not alone in their problems. It's a short and nasty life out there on the street. And a little stay in a shelter with an attentive staff, and I include the listening house, Ann Harris, and Kate and Katie, two former staff workers at Dorothy Day that are running the safe waiting hours between 5:30 and 8:30 are a real important component of the shelter program. They really provide a lot of one-on-one counseling and friendship that is otherwise missing in a lot of people's lives every day. And the same way with the staff at Dorothy Day. There's just a lot of interaction that is a lot of benefit to people, a lot of support, a lot of listening that otherwise these people would not receive. And it's cheap, let me tell you. It's a cheap benefit considering the alternative of having 150 to 170 people on the street every night with nowhere to go. A lot of these people, you would be amazed at the sense of gratitude and gratefulness that even though these people are suffering rough times, expressed about having this little space, having that little mat, and that donated blanket and sheet to sleep on. There's a sense of gratitude and a sense of sharing that would oftentimes surprise you. I know in the past we've had different legislators, groups of legislators come by and visit, and I encourage you to give Fred Wood a call at Dorothy Day, and he'll set up a visit for you if you'd like to come by some night and visit.
I can interrupt you for just a minute, Mr. Phoenix. We're going actually out of time.
I'm sorry about that.
The committee does meet only until 10 o'clock.
Okay.
We did have the opportunity last year to visit the shelter, and we appreciate it. Representative Clark, I don't know if you used to have
if I could beg the committee's indulgence, we have two people from out of town. I'm wondering if we could just ask
Representative Gunther.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Clark, we have another committee coming in here, but we've probably got about, we'll give you 2 minutes total. And first, before we do that, I will move this bill for possible inclusion in a possible funding bill. And thought we better do that first.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Appreciate that. I wonder if Kim Houston and Jenny Larson could just come down, at least briefly, introduce yourself, and say where you're from.
Thank you for coming. Please state your name for the committee.
My name is Kim Husted, Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members, for giving me a brief moment to personalize homelessness as a rural issue in Minnesota. As the Housing Services Director at the Arrowhead Economic Opportunity Agency, AEOA is a community action agency serving the 16,000 square miles in the Arrowhead region. As the Housing Services Director, I'm exposed to a variety of affordable housing issues ranging from housing development, energy conservation, and real estate. But today I'm here to focus on the issue of homelessness. AEOA operates some homeless shelters and transitional housing units throughout the Arrowhead region, primarily in Virginia, Hibbing, and Two Harbors. We have Bill's House located in Virginia, which is considered a national model because of the community support, case management, and success. I know that we are running out of time, but I do need to read you a story. The story is an 18-year-old female who had been sleeping in the garage called the shelter for a bed. We had no room, so we put her up at a hotel for the weekend. On Monday, a bed became available. Jane had been homeless most of her life. Her mother dropped her off at a police station and never returned. From there, she was in and out of foster homes, and at the age of 14, she joined a traveling carnival. During the course of her stay, we realized that Jane had no identification and no Social Security card. We helped her obtain those so she could get financial assistance. She was also she had no high school diploma or GED. She was also diagnosed with post-trauma stress disorder. Today, where is Jane? She has a full-time job, an apartment, her GED, and is enrolled in college next fall. And Jane said this apartment was her first place she could call home. Last year, just some really quick statistics. Last year, we served 220 households. 35% were children. Last quarter, August through October, we turned away 160 households.
Thank you. I appreciate it. I'm sorry. We're running out of time. Representative Clark, 30 seconds. You look like you want to have her say something, so we're going to...
My name is Shelley McNamara, and I'm one of the lucky ones. I was in a shelter. I'm from a family that was upper middle class, very educated parents and educated grandparents. I suffered with a genetic disorder that I was born with, and I was in a relationship with my ex-husband who was very abusive. I had to leave my stepson behind, which is very difficult. The shelter is a very frightening atmosphere for somebody like myself. And they are ships to take people to a place that's safe, but there are too few of them, and only a few of the lucky ones, like me, really get to benefit from it. I wish I had more time. I have a few pages written here, but thank you so much for listening.
I apologize, we just don't have time. I appreciate it. Representative Clark, I appreciate everything
Mr. Chair, if one of the witnesses have...
Representative Mahoney.
Mr. Chair, if the witnesses have written testimony, they could please submit it.
Be happy to take it if you'd like to submit it. And we'll make sure everybody gets a copy of it.
Mr. Chair,
with that, Representative Clark, we're going to lay over House File 1997 for possible inclusion in a possible omnibus funding bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I agree.
We're adjourned.